Welcome to Money Maze Curated Podcasts. We created this spin-off channel to highlight a selection of innovative firms in the finance sector and beyond. If you visit www.moneymazepodcast.com, you can also sign up to our newsletter to keep up to date with episode releases and access a range of resources and materials relevant to each guest. If you enjoy this episode, please follow this channel and leave a review. Thank you for listening. What could go right is a question investors sometimes need to ask, particularly when an asset class, region, or style of investing is unloved, out of favor, and under-allocated to. I'm referring to emerging markets. At times in my career, emerging markets have been the hottest investment theme around, and yet today it's the polar opposite, and it might earn them the designation of being the most unloved in a generation. And perhaps, as George Soros once said, we should discount the obvious and expect the unexpected. With that, we welcome to the Money Maze Curated channel Dr. Christina Maguire, owner and CIO of Elephant Asset Management, who first appeared on the Money Maze podcast in September 2020 as the world dealt with the COVID ramifications and investors tried to understand winners and losers. So, Christina, good morning. And first of all, welcome back.
Good morning, Simon. Thank you for having me again.
Well, I know you are always on the move, and we're going to talk about some of those research trips that you do. And I know you are reaching us from a hotel room today with Wi-Fi that may be uncertain, but we hope this is all going to work beautifully in audio and video. I've followed your thinking and research in the intervening years. And as you wrote recently, valuation anomalies like this come along rarely. And in talking with Will Campion and you, we agreed it was timely to review the emerging market landscape as seen through your lens, which is a very unusual and specific one. For reference, in our first interview, you described your journey from growing up in Germany, becoming a doctor, practicing in some emerging countries with fragile health systems, before deciding and switching to go to Harvard Business School, joining Goldman Sachs Asset Management, working with the legendary David Blood, staying there a decade, and specializing as a portfolio manager in emerging markets. The full story and some of your great anecdotes I re-listened to when I went through the episode at the weekend. Anyway, we hope today we're going to review your business, your investment process, the opportunities that you're so excited about, the skills that you think you can deploy given that you've done this for a long time, the challenges and why you're so excited. So, Christine, that sound all right?
That sounds amazing. Yes. Thank you, Simon.
Okay. So let's start with Elephant Asset Management. What was the motivation to start it?
We wanted to give investors a very pointed and pure exposure to emerging markets. I looked around and the emerging market funds that I saw mostly held a lot of portfolio holdings that were part of the MSCI EM. And I felt a lot of these markets, or indeed the companies, were not really truly emerging market companies. You found a lot of companies that export to developed markets. And so the drivers were actually not what we're looking for when we want to invest in emerging markets. So we thought we're going to do something different. We thought we will provide investors with exposure to a smaller, very concentrated set of companies that are truly driven by their home markets. And that would give investors exposure to companies that they might find more difficult to find by themselves because they are less covered by sell or buy side. And that would hopefully increase their opportunity for return without actually increasing the risk by doubling up on stocks they already have in their benchmark portfolio.
And the name Elephant Asset Management?
Elephant obviously exists in Africa and Asia. Now, you could say Tiger would be a more appropriate name, but that was obviously taken. So we went with Elephant. The other thing was, we felt elephants have thick skin, which we knew we would need in emerging markets, small cap in particular. And then lastly, I should say, and many people don't really know that, but most elephant herds are actually led by a female elephant. So there you go.
Right. And I know you are a female-owned business. So you have been building, running this business since 2016. And I guess, in short, it's a concentrated, stock-specific, small to mid-cap emerging market equity fund. And we can dive into the elements of that. So let's start with the investment philosophy. At a country level, first of all, what do you want or not want to see?
That goes right to the point, Simon, because we have selected a group of eight countries that we want to invest in. I should say that these eight have never changed since inception of the fund. And perhaps just to name them, they are China, India. They are the countries of the ASEAN region, namely Indonesia, Thailand, Malaysia, and the Philippines, and then South Africa and Kenya on the African continent. Now, what binds those eight together is, first of all of these eight countries largely adhere to IFRS accounting standards, which was quite important to us. We can talk about that later, but obviously corporate governance and accounting features large in our investment space. Secondly, all of these eight countries already have an existing middle class, but which is still growing quite strongly. So it's not just about food and shelter, as you might find more in Pakistan or Bangladesh, but these populations already have some discretionary incomes and they can spend it on a little bit of private healthcare or some lower end luxuries. The last point was that we do have a bit of an ESG overlay on the fund. We're an Article 8 registered fund, which means we don't invest in extractive industries. And those countries are not dominated by the extractive sector, which is something that you find in a lot of other emerging markets, obviously, especially in Africa. But Kenya is one of these few markets in Africa that actually doesn't have a lot of natural resources. So when you look at the composition of the Kenyan stock market, it looks very much like an ASEAN market, really. So that was the main reason for these eight countries. And coming back to your questions, we believe that in this eight, the equity markets are deep enough so that we as stock pickers find a large enough set of opportunities that fulfill the risk return profiles we're looking for.
So let's talk about that idea generation. I know you have been doing this for a long time, and so one has an inventory of acquaintance of companies that one might have owned or might have looked at. But tell us a little bit about how you source your ideas.
What we don't typically do is an equity screening process on Bloomberg. And the reason is that we have found in the countries we invest in and the market cap segment we invest in, the equity screen is not very reliable. Companies get misclassified. You simply can't find them. So what we do instead is we come from a theme. So we look for a specific theme that we think is interesting in these countries. It can be fintech, it can be AI hardware, but we are starting off from a theme and then we see where we want to be in the value chain. So remember, in small midcap, it is terribly important that you're not looking at a massive customer and a massive supplier and you get sandwiched in between and, you know, upstream and downstream, everybody's taking advantage of you. But it is really important for us to understand how the value chain flows and where we want to be positioned within that value chain. And that tends to be our starting point. So that's where we start our due diligence, and we can do that from London. We can learn about the industry. We can look upstream and downstream and then make a decision where we want to be. And then we look at what companies are listed in that spot where we decided that we would like to invest in. That's our starting point.
And one of the hallmarks of your universe is that the sell side, and maybe even the buy side, research coverage is thin. And I was puzzling, I suppose, is that an asset or is that a drawback?
I think it's both, really. The asset is that because there is so little coverage, as you rightly point out, there are a lot larger pricing inefficiencies that you can exploit when you get it right. And that is the beauty of it. Not many people look at it. And so therefore you find fantastic little company, little gems that are trading at highly attractive valuations. Now, the flip side of that is that A, you have to go out and do all the due diligence yourself. So it becomes a little bit private equity-like. And I go to all of our eight markets about twice a year to really kick the tires and meet with the company management teams on the ground at their headquarters, look at the factories, look at the labs, make sure the assets are really there. The other drawback, I would say, is that sometimes it takes a little bit longer for these investment cases to come to fruition. When we enter a company when we build up a position, what sometimes happens is that by the time we enter, there's perhaps one or two domestic brokers that might be looking at the company, certainly no international broker. And the company then needs to perform. Earnings growth needs to come through. And at some point, more domestic sell-side brokers or even international will look at the company, will write an initiation report. And that is usually the time when you get the re-rating. That can take a while. And sometimes we just need to be patient.
And let's just drill down onto those research trips. When you are going to, whether it's the Philippines or Malaysia or Indonesia, and you have the companies that you might own or you're looking at, what defines a successful outcome? I.e., what's on your must-have checklist when you hit the ground?
Let me just go one step back. By the time when we actually go on the ground and we meet the companies, we have usually done quite a lot of groundwork on that company and the industry. So we tend to start our due diligence process sitting in London, doing all of the industry research, doing our numbers, building models for the peers, just getting a really good idea about the industry and the company and management track record, background, and so on. Usually we have had one introductory call with the management team before we go and visit them on the ground. Once we're there, I want to see the asset base. Let's just assume it is a manufacturing company. I want to see the factories. I want to speak to the plant manager. Ideally, I'd like to go and speak to the employees. I think in our previous podcast, we talked about that my favorite due diligence point is to have lunch in the canteen with the workers and really get an idea of the vibe, of the atmosphere in the company. Are workers happy? Is the food decent? Does management sit with them? Or is it all very segregated? And what we're trying to do is we're trying to build a mosaic and just get an overall picture out of a lot of little pieces of information. What I would like to see is workers or staff that do not churn a lot, that have worked at the company for a number of years in factories. I'd love to hear when some of the workers say, yes, my dad has worked here and I've been working here for the past 10 years and so on. So those are always really interesting and valuable points of information. I'd like to get a feel for the management team. And that might sound very sort of soft and opaque, but corporate governance is a really big deal in small cap emerging markets. And although we've been fortunate so far, I believe if a company management team wants to commit corporate fraud, it is quite difficult for an external shareholder to detect that ahead of time. But what I firmly believe we can do is that if a management team is willing to commit corporate fraud, they tend to be quite fast and loose with other things too. And that you can pick up on. And so if I sit in front of a management team and I have the feeling that something is not quite right, then given that we only have a maximum of 25 holdings in the portfolio, we have the luxury to cherry pick and we just don't need to be there. I would absolutely concede that we sometimes are perhaps overly cautious, and some of the stocks where we said no rallied hard and you could argue we've missed it. On the other hand, we have also sidestepped a significant number of landmines in our markets. And so on balance, I think we got this part of the process right. But coming back to your question of what we are generally looking for. So it is the vibe of the company. It's the atmosphere. We are trying to make sure that the management team is long-term focused. The management team is properly incentivized. Middle management and top management is in sync with regards to the strategy and what they want to achieve for the company. So those are the main bits. And then, of course, we kick the tires with the CFO on the numbers, but that goes without saying, but it is really those softer bits that tell you a lot. Does the company have a headquarter that is very ostentatious, or is it quite utilitarian and you feel, yes, they are probably not spending a lot on SG&A? And we've got a few good stories where we thought everything stacked up and our company visit was just the last tick in the box. And then the company had like three Maybachs in front of a dilapidated headquarters in the middle of Ahmedabad. So those little things tend to pique your interest and warn you about potential mismatches.
Yeah, there was an echo when we interviewed Carson Block, famous short seller. He had alighted on a Chinese paper company he was suspicious about, and he went to the factory and he said, I don't know anything about paper. So he took a paper expert with him and he looked around the factory and came out and said to his colleague, yeah, it looks okay to me. And the guy said, never, never could you make that much paper in a factory with so much damp. So there you go. And so your site visits absolutely are essential. When we think about the profile of the companies, you know, in the West, we talk a lot about growth and, you know, value. But tell us a little bit about the growth trajectories that you are wanting to see or building into your models as you do your work and own these companies.
Our ideal investment target is a company that is still quite young and early in its life cycle. What we often like to do is we like to look at companies before they become big and liquid enough for us to invest in them, because that gives us a chance to get to know them over time. And once they move into our target range in terms of their market cap and average daily trading liquidity, we know them well enough so that we can make a decision. What we look for is companies, or we like companies, that occupy a niche when it comes to their services or goods. And again, I'm now coming here from the small mid-cap side. We like companies that are not sandwiched between gorillas in terms of customers or suppliers, but companies that can dominate a certain niche within any given industry, a niche that is hopefully too small for any of the big competitors to be attracted to it. The other thing in our companies, and of course China here comes to mind, is these niche industries rarely attract regulatory or government attention, and that in our view can really only be a good thing. We look for companies that have a roadmap, a 5 to 10 year roadmap. Our investment style is purely structural. We don't do any technical trades. So you will probably never find a video gaming company in our portfolio, because we find it very difficult to establish what the next hit will be in terms of the next game. We like companies where we see product innovation, a process by the management team to come up with new services and goods over the next 10 years. That is very important to us, because our average holding period is about 4 to 5 years. We're not looking for companies that beat the next quarterly earnings.
So these are essentially, or for the most part, domestically focused businesses.
Entirely.
Playing to the theme of growing GDP per capita. I think you observed in the past that when you talk to institutional investors, some of them say, gosh, I don't recognize any of the names in your portfolio.
Correct. Yes. That's really the ideal outcome, because that is our mission. That is what we're trying to achieve, to give you exposure to a roster of fantastic little companies that can hopefully give you the return you're looking for, but without doubling up on what you already have.
So I'd love to look at one or two examples in one or two countries, so you can just give everybody a flavor of what the dynamics are and why you own that company.
Let's perhaps talk about a Chinese company. It is called DPC Dash. And DPC Dash is the master franchisee of Domino's Pizza in China. Let me just take one step back and give you just a general structural growth story here. So China, actually, in terms of pizza stores per million of population, is the lowest globally in the major countries. So just to give you a flavor, in China, you have about 7.5 stores per million. In Taiwan, you've got 25. Even in India, you have about 12. And of course, the US is off the chart with over 200. But you can see the structural growth story here from a service or a good that at the moment seems to be underpenetrated in a country with a lot of potential where people can afford a pizza. And there is just a general tailwind of strong growth if you just play the penetration. Now, the lay of the land, the market at the moment looks like this. So Pizza Hut is by far the market leader with a 35% market share, has been in the country for a very long time, has educated the Chinese consumer in terms of how to eat pizza, to like pizza, and has done a phenomenal job, to be honest. DPC or Domino's Pizza has come in later and has at the moment about a 6% market share. Lots to catch up on. And the way Domino's Pizza is doing it is really interesting. So first of all, the store economics are more favorable than for Pizza Hut. Domino's needs smaller stores because it's mainly delivery, a lot fewer employees per store. They don't really need to be in areas of very high footfall because it is less about dining in. And so the rent is lower per store. And so the store economics are incredibly favorable. Then couple that with the Chinese tailwind of seeking out more value for money consumption. We've seen that has been a trend since the end of the COVID lockdown, that the Chinese consumer actually is going more for value. And Domino's Pizza is on average priced 10 to 15% below Pizza Hut. And one KPI that always I find astonishing is of all of the Domino's Pizza stores globally, the top 20 by first 30-day sales are all in China. And they are not necessarily in the tier one cities like Beijing, Shanghai, Shenzhen. They are in lower tier cities. So people clearly like it. They are excited about a Domino's Pizza opening. There are massive crowds when one of these stores open. And you can just see the structural tailwind there.
Can I just pause you there, Christina? Just give us a sense of the valuation.
Yes. Valuation is interesting here because Domino's Pizza or DPC has only in 2024 turned a profit. So we are still at the very early stages here. So we've been one of the earlier foreign investors in this company. Liquidity wasn't terribly good. It is improving as we speak. It is at the moment a 750 million free float company, with a free float of only about 55%. The rest is owned by the founders, the management team, and by Domino's Pizza US, the master franchisee. So liquidity is not terribly good, but it's been improving. Valuations, we look at it predominantly on a price to cash flow basis. And here you are looking, and I'm now rolling it over to 2026, below 10 times. And I think that is still very conservative because we are at the very beginning of this growth story. Right now, the corporate headquarter costs are still quite big and you are not allocating that across a huge number of stores. That will change in the coming years forward. And so my argument is that you need to look a little bit ahead and then discount it back to get to a true number. But on a price to cash flow basis, it is trading at the moment at high single digits on 2026 numbers. One thing I would say, and that is for us always terribly important, is the quality of the management. So the management in this case are all Chinese, but with a background in McDonald's, Estee Lauder, a lot of MNC consumer companies, consumer facing companies, properly incentivized, not only in terms of their pay package, but as I mentioned earlier, they do outright own shares in the company. And that is to us, that is one of the things that we look at very, very carefully, because we do want the management team to be strongly aligned with us, the minority shareholders.
And before we leave the Chinese example, obviously it's front and center stage in the geopolitical discussions. We had James Anderson from formerly Scottish Mortgage, now Lingotto, talk about the need to cooperate and to quietly, you know, maintain these essential commercial relationships. We've had Scott Bessent, now Treasury Secretary, talk about risk being sort of the Russian style risk when an equity market suddenly is shut down for outside investors. I know you can't worry about the geopolitical risk because it's beyond any of our control, but how do you think about the Chinese element in your portfolio?
There is no doubt that in the past few years, geopolitics have loomed a lot larger in our portfolio process than pre-COVID. Sitting here pre-COVID, I probably would have told you that geopolitics is sort of at the back of our mind, but doesn't really feature very large. It's all about idiosyncratic risk. Sitting here today, I think it would be foolish to say that. We, of course, need to have in mind what geopolitics are doing to our companies. Now, on the fundamental company level, I would say, though, that given that we don't invest in exporters or indeed any company that derives a lot of their revenue from outside their home market, tariffs don't usually faze our companies. So we are more talking about valuation and sentiment, and that is a valid point. However, I do believe that at some point, cash flow will matter again. And you can imagine that it's been a source of a lot of frustration for us to see our companies continuing to perform well operationally, because from an operational point of view, they are not exposed to tariffs or any of that sort. So continuing to perform very well operationally with an earnings growth of 30%, but yet the derating has been significant. And that is the main reason why we are pounding the table so strongly on this asset class right now. And we do believe it warrants a very close look, because as you pointed out in your introductory remarks, Simon, the Wall Street Journal article said that the relation, the PE ratio between, I think it was this, the S&P 500 that they cited and the MSCI EM, is now at a 50-year low. It is below the levels we saw during the Asian debt crisis. This is nothing like the Asian debt crisis, and we believe it will eventually turn around. It has been going on longer than we all thought, but cash flows at some point will matter again, we're sure.
Yep, and you know, the cynic would say, well, maybe in 2 years' time, it's at a 52-year low. But I am reminded of the late, great Barton Biggs, Morgan Stanley strategist, who said, nobody rings a bell at the bottom of a bear market. Christy, you are also going to give us another example so we can think through your approach.
Let me give you an example that is a bit wobbly at the moment. I want to talk about Cimory, which is an Indonesian dairy manufacturer and consumer foods manufacturer. It's a company that we really like, and we got in early on, not long after they went public in the Jakarta stock market. It is a company that we were drawn to because of the quality of the management team. So a typical story, dad founded the company, the two sons have taken it over. One is responsible for the dairy part, the yogurt part. The other one is responsible for the consumer foods part. And what we like about the company is that, first of all, the dairy part is a really underpenetrated market in Indonesia. So there was a lot of education to be done to bring in the Indonesian consumer to the yogurt market. The market is too small for the likes of the Unilevers, for example, to get in. So it's a lovely example of a niche market that can be dominated by a local company, can be grown, the pie can be grown by a local company without an imminent threat by an international competitor. The company has done incredibly well over the past few years. It has been picked up by international sell side now in terms of coverage. It has enjoyed a re-rating on top of their 20-25% earnings growth that it has posted since going public. So it's been a great story for us. When we initiated a holding initially, the stock was valued at a PE in the mid-teens. As I said, for a 25% earnings growth, great ROE, clean balance sheet, everything you want. It has lately hit a little bit of a roadblock. And that is because the Indonesian government is toying with the idea of introducing a sugar tax. And the investor community is now terribly worried that that might hit the margins and the top line of Chimori. Now, we've had extensive conversations with the management team who have already sourced alternatives to sugar. They have brought out, they've launched low sugar items, and they believe that they can fully mitigate it. However, the market has really sold it down by about 18% over the last few months. This is one of these examples where we think if you have a longer term investment horizon, this is where we add to our holdings. And that is why the longer investment horizon is really so terribly important, because you do have these moments, especially in small mid-cap in emerging markets, where sentiment takes over and these stocks move quite significantly, a lot more significantly than in the developed world or in the large cap segment. And if you know the companies well, you have good access to the management team and can discuss the concerns that you have, and you are lucky to have an investor base with a longer term investment horizon, then you can really take advantage of these incredible opportunities where you can get a phenomenal company for a relatively inexpensive price.
Yes. So when we think about the mistakes that occur on the journey of every portfolio manager, as they have occurred on yours, what one or two things have you absolutely taken away? And if you have, has that altered your process?
We conduct quite thorough postmortems whenever we exit a company. And we absolutely do make mistakes. And it is very, very important to make sure that you understand whether an investment case has worked out because you were lucky, because you were right, or if it hasn't, whether you were just wrong in your investment thesis or whether you were simply unlucky. And I think that is the only way to learn to become a better investor going forward. The things that we've done wrong, I've done wrong, are manifold. Actually, the first one I would say, and that just comes to mind because it's a mistake I think I made in the last couple of years, and that is to be perhaps slightly too cautious on the valuation side. And what I mean by that, we derive target prices on every company that we look at, and we tend to be quite disciplined when it comes to trimming or even selling out of positions once they hit our target price. In the last few years, it has surfaced that that hasn't really worked in a number of cases, that the investor community takes great comfort from stories, from companies that deliver sustainable earnings growth, management teams with a great track record, and investors are willing to pay up for that high quality growth. So I would say my mistake was that some of our holdings in the portfolio are perhaps not incredibly cheap anymore, but the company has reliably delivered. The management team has cautiously and successfully guided the company through the post-COVID world and probably deserves a premium valuation. I have trimmed these portfolio holdings probably too aggressively because I was worried about the valuation level and I should have let the winners run harder. So my takeaway here is that I need to become a little bit, I need to be more holistic in the way I look at these companies, our target prices, their valuations at this point in time, and perhaps look at them a little bit more relative when it comes to, okay, what is the sustainability, the earnings visibility of that company, and is it worth paying a premium for that sort of thing? So that's the first thing. The other thing that you always learn over the years is, and you kind of know it when you put on a position, that you believe too early in a turnaround. There is this sweet spot between, you know, a company that is coming out of a hole and it looks like KPIs are turning a little bit more positive and you are just a little bit too early and you get bitten. In, you know, small mid-cap emerging markets, those can be value traps and it just takes a lot longer for the story to surface. So being perhaps a bit more patient there hopefully will deliver superior results going forward.
Let's just talk about the benchmark. You made an observation a while back that you clients actually come to you for absolute, not relative returns, which of course makes sense. But you know, we're in an industry where performance is benchmarked. How do you think about your benchmark?
Terribly difficult, Simon. It's a very difficult topic for us. And the reason is that the traditional emerging market benchmarks are just pretty meaningless to us. So if you look at the MSCI EM, we don't invest in 55% of the countries that MSCI EM represent. We don't invest in Taiwan, Korea, of course, LATAM is not there, and so on. So that's a problem. The other problem, we attempted to equal weight the country indices of the 8 markets we are in and use that. The problem we have is that we don't invest in extractive industries, so no oil and gas, no commodities. Because of the market cap range that we target, we will never have any large cap banks. And when you look at the underlying country indices, these are dominated by these three sectors. So for example, if you look at the Indonesian index, for example, and I just have it present because we recently have done this exercise, you look at the underlying index, and basically, we can't invest in 70% of that index. So again, it is not particularly meaningful. We try to strip it down to the market cap range we can invest in and strip out the extractive industries and so on. And you come up with an index that has 8 stocks left, which is obviously not a valid benchmark. So long-winded answer, it is very difficult. And we have decided to simply resign ourselves to the fact that at times when commodities are rallying or when large cap banks dominate, we do underperform. But as we know, it's always a cycle and there will be times when those sectors underperform. And you know, in both cases, in one situation, we might look a little bit worse than perhaps we should. And at other times, we might look a little bit better relative than we should.
But you are playing the emergence, the growth, the future profitability, the capital uplift. Tell us just the type of clients best suited to what you do.
Investors need, above all, a longer investment horizon. As mentioned, we invest in structural investment cases. We don't do any tactical trading. It is also the nature of investing in smaller companies that we simply can't move that quickly. So it takes us probably a couple of weeks to move in and out of positions. And, you know, if we believe in the underlying growth story of our companies, we don't want to sell them at times when sentiment turns against them. Quite the opposite. That's the time to buy. If you believe that the fundamental investment case still stands. So you need a longer investment horizon. We realize we've asked for a lot of patience in this cycle from our investors, but that is the nature of the beast. We make sure that our investor base knows exactly what we do in the portfolio. I believe we give exceptional transparency to our investors. We are happy to discuss any holdings and give any exposure, weights, whatever allocators would like to have from us. But it is important that the investor understands that there will be volatility. And I would expect that as we underwrite our companies in the portfolio, if sentiment turns against them, while operationally they are doing fine, I would expect our investors to have the breath and patience to look through that. So typically, it is mostly an institutional investor base, university endowments, charitable foundations, pension funds, family offices. That's the investor base that we found likes this product most. And we've been incredibly fortunate with our investor base. And it shows that our investors truly know and understand what it is they are investing in.
Well, I know that you have quite an important US client following from those sort of institutions. And originally you'd said the capacity for your fund would be capped at $500 million US. Has that changed? And, you know, you're about half the way there. Is that right?
That's correct. So interestingly, our investors have actually pushed us to reconsider that. And the arguments were very compelling, I thought. So firstly, the inflation has played a big role over the past eight and a half years since inception. So that is probably one characteristic that should feature in calculating the overall capacity. But what I actually think is more important is the fact when we set out, we had a very firm market cap range of between, on a free float basis, 100 million to about 2 billion US dollar. We felt that was a sweet spot where there was not that much sell side coverage. The buy side wasn't looking at it. And that was a range where we felt very comfortable investing in. Over the years, and as emerging markets have become less favored or more hated, I should say, a lot of the investor base and a lot of the sell side has actually started to move up that market cap curve. So the spirit of picking companies that are not very well discovered, that is actually now applicable to, I would argue, a market cap range that is a little bit larger than what I just mentioned, which we had in mind at inception. Liquidity has also drained out of these markets to a certain degree because foreign capital has moved out of these countries in more recent years. And when you take liquidity and market cap range into consideration, I would argue that with the same underlying mission and idea for the portfolio, we would be easily able to accommodate a $600 million fund and change absolutely nothing in the investment philosophy and strategy.
So, Christina, just staying with the allocator question, there is resistance, as we know, as evidenced by the underweights. What is the typical explanation for that resistance?
Interesting question. And I've just been in January in the US to visit our existing investors and talk to potentially new ones. And I found that the allocator community is really in two camps. The first camp is, look at what the US has done. Why would I look anywhere else and take on emerging market risk if I can have a much better risk return profile in the US? The other argument from that camp is the question, has President Xi broken China and will it ever recover again? So that camp is, as you rightly say, sort of very adverse to investing in China. The other camp acknowledges the incredible valuation opportunity that we are seeing in our markets while these companies are still providing significant and impressive earnings growth. And our pitch here is you should really look at this as a very inexpensive call option. In our view, the risk return profile is immense, and we are seeing relatively limited downside from here. I think all of the negative tariff news has largely been discounted. You know, January was a very, very difficult month for small cap EM. And I think we've seen a lot of the tariff news getting flushed out from stock valuations. But at the same time, now the return potential is incredible. We got a little bit of an inkling of that in late September. You might remember when the Chinese government came out with their first stimulus announcement and the Chinese market rallied 35% in just a few trading days. And we believe that that return potential is there while the downside risk at these levels is relatively mitigated. So the worry here is a little bit that the first camp will wait until EM rallies and then picks up the phone and wants to know more. By that time, you will probably have missed the first large rally. And we would never advocate to be overweight emerging market at this point, but I think it is very well worth having a look at it and considering even just a small exposure to make sure that you are part of that rally when it happens.
Great. I have three closing questions. When I went back through my earlier conversation with you, you said that when you were at Harvard Business School, both Warren Buffett and Jeff Bezos visited to give lectures. What did you take from each of them?
So Warren Buffett, I mean, the value investing part and just investing into something that you truly understand is always, for me, a really valuable lesson to be learned. We look at all sectors. We look at some interesting business models. And it is very important when you do that, that you realize what you don't understand and to stay away and not engage and FOMO and follow perhaps the local retail investors that are racing into one type of stock. Process is so important in our markets and especially in a bear market. And I, you know, you can imagine at the moment I'm giving a lot of pep talks to our team because it is terribly frustrating to get the numbers right and still the stocks don't perform. But I truly believe that this is not the time to throw out your process, but really to stick to it and make sure that you know why you hold these companies and don't chase anything just because there is a momentum trade going on right now. It's tough, but I think Warren Buffett is absolutely spot on. Jeff Bezos, back then, it was still very early days. I would say tenacity is probably the one thing that I take with me from that time. If we think about how many times, I forgot, I think it was three times that Amazon stock was down 80 or 90% in these first years. And the fact that he just kept going, believed in his vision, believed in his process. And eventually, my God, we are where we are right now. But it was not a smooth and linear ride. And that is very typical of the small companies we are looking at today. It is never a linear ride. In fact, if it is, there's probably something wrong here. And as long as the management teams follow their long-term vision, execute for the long term, and be transparent about the problems they are facing, we are willing to underwrite those portfolio positions. So tenacity is what I took away from Jeff Bezos.
My final question is that we've partnered with GAIN, Girls Are Investors, to encourage women to join the investment industry. You have been very successfully executing your career. What advice would you give to younger women thinking about the investment business?
It is a fantastic job for women and also for mothers. The beautiful thing is that you don't have to be at a certain place to do your research, to do your calls with management teams. And I would love for more young women to consider this career path as an option, because I firmly believe it is a wonderful one for women. I don't understand why there are so few of us left. And we do have quite a number of female research analysts. Somehow we are not doing a good job as an industry of keeping them to migrate to the next level. And I think we really need to ask ourselves what we are doing wrong here, because it is a fantastic job that you can do, even if you have a family. A lot of what you do is thinking, reading, interacting with people you source information from. All of this does not require that you sit in your office for 12 hours a day. You can easily do these things from home. And I wished more young women would be considering it.
Very clear. Thank you. Christina, it's been great catching up with you today. I've written a few things down. The investment opportunity is immense. And as some of those investors said, well, the US has been the best place to be. You know, there's an inherent danger in looking in the rearview mirror. So I think I'm right in saying you're adding to your own holding in the fund. Having invested myself in emerging markets over the years, I don't have any to date, so I'm going to take a much closer look. I might well invest with you. And I have to say that the disconnect of allocators not wanting to go there, but the bottom-up opportunities being immense, to use your words, you know, is very attractive. So maybe I can steal the Heineken advert and say your portfolio management approach reaches the parts that other portfolios don't normally access. So, Christina, thank you so much for being here. And I should say that your written reports, which are called View from the Ground, are in really excellently thought through and written and forward be invested. I think it's a great way to start to understand how you think.
Thank you so much, Simon. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about the emerging market asset class and the fund. I think it is a fantastic opportunity and I really appreciate it. Thank you.
All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making or refraining from making any specific investment or other decisions. We try to provide content that is true and accurate as of the date of publishing. However, we give no assurance or warranty regarding the accuracy, timeliness, or applicability of any of the content. Guests, presenters, and other individuals involved in the production of this podcast may have positions in any of the investments discussed.